Our next case this morning is number 054247, the United States against Scott. Mr. Delia.
May it please the court, my name is Anthony Delier, and I represent Levy Scott. There was a motion filed late in this case regarding the failure of the court to provide Mr. Scott with an opportunity for allocution. I will briefly address that at the beginning. In Green versus United States, 365 U.S. 301 at 304, the court said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the design of Rule 32A did not begin with its promulgation. Its genesis was in the common law right of allocution. As early as 1689, it was recognized that the court's failure to ask the defendant if he had anything to say before sentencing was imposed, required reversal.
Did you object in the district court?
I did not. It was an error that I made, Your Honor.
This would have to be reviewed then under the plain error doctrine, wouldn't it?
Correct.
And your defendant was sentenced, as I recall, at the low end of the guideline?
That is correct, Your Honor.
How does that impact on the plain error analysis?
That would take us right into our main argument of the case today, if I may. We are fortunate that United States versus Miller, 450 F3rd 270, was recently decided by this court. This case notes that the sentencing guidelines were deprived of the quality of law by the Booker court. And then the next breath goes on to say that it allows judges to resolve factual disputes much as they had before. And later mandates that the district judges must carry out the legislative choices made by Congress. And this is one view of the law. Levy Scott has a different view of the law. Under 18 United States Code 3353A2A, the court is directed to consider the seriousness of the offense. And then again, in 183553A4, the court is directed to consider the offense. This is not redundant language. And what it is essentially saying is, we want you to consider this particular offense with this particular defendant.
Didn't this defendant have a pre-sentence hearing as well as a sentencing hearing? A pre-sentencing hearing. Did he have that as well?
I don't believe so, Your
Honor. Scott did?
No, sir.
Wasn't he over before the judge at an earlier date? And didn't she go over with him the possible penalties?
We just had the one sentencing hearing, Your Honor.
No, I said a pre-sentencing hearing and a sentencing hearing on two different occasions.
No.
No, all right.
Okay. And so there are these two views of the law. I think we need to take a look at exactly what we're saying here. Under Miller, the guidelines are not, theoretically at least, mandatory.
Counsel, Miller is not just a view of the law. It's binding precedent. Are you suggesting it be overruled? It's only a month old.
I am, in fact, suggesting exactly that. And the reason why is clear. The law is 183553. That's the law.
Tell him to get it fast.
The law says that the judge must consider the seriousness of the offense. It then goes on to say that the judge must consider the guidelines. It gives two different directives. What happened in this case and what is happening in many of these cases is the judges are considering the guidelines, and that's it. And they're essentially still mandatory. But more importantly than that, they're ignoring the law. The law is 183553. It hasn't been done away with. The Booker court didn't say 3553A is no longer law. It said 3553B is no longer law.
The 100-to-1 differential between crack and powder cocaine is statutory as well as guidelines-based, is it not? And the import of Miller is to say that sentencing courts can't ignore the legislative choice?
Absolutely not in this case. What it does is it sets the minimum and the maximum sentences. It has nothing to do with the guidelines. The guidelines are just that, advisory. But, you know, the Congress, and rightfully so, the Miller Court is correct, has the ability to make a law. They made a law that said, if this is the quantity, this is the statutory sentence. They can do that, and the court has really no authority to deny that. But what they did was they made a sentencing guidelines that was unconstitutional. And that's essentially what's happening here. We're taking these unconstitutional sentencing guidelines and we're using them to impose sentences. And more importantly, we're doing that in direct contradiction of the law, which is 1833-53A. That is the essence of the problem we have here. So then I want to move on to reasonableness. Let's talk about just how reasonable it is. We all know that the United States Sentencing Guidelines unanimously were repudiated by the United States Sentencing Commission. There is nobody, really, there is no other comparable body of experts to that commission. And they have repudiated the guidelines. And yet, the courts are directed under this current law, under the precedent set by Miller, to use those very guidelines. This is something that occurred to me to just show you how this might work. Because one of the problems that we have in Madison, Wisconsin, there's a nightclub right downtown where a lot of young kids hang out and play rap music, and there have been shootings and all kinds of violence there. So really, a similar thing to do would be to say, well, you know, there's a lot of violence there. There's a lot of drug activity. There's a lot of bad things going on. It has a lot to do with that rap music. So what we're going to do is we're going to change our ordinance. Instead of having it be a $100 fine for playing loud music in your car, we're going to make it 100-1 if it happens to be rap music, because rap music is just worse than regular music when it's played too loud. And that's essentially what the 100-1 guidelines is. Now, it turns out that the nightclubs that I'm talking about in Madison are probably about 80% black people and 20% white people. So it would be pretty similar to this. We'd be given $10,000 fines to 80% black kids and 20% white kids instead of the $100 fine that the 80% white kids and 20% of black kids would get for listening to the white music. And there's really no plainer way to say that. I understand that these courts have found in prior case law before the guidelines became advisory that this was reasonable, that it was the intent of Congress, that the standard of review did not allow us to look at that. But 3553A tells a judge that they must look at that, that they must look at how serious is this crime in comparison. I see my time has run low. Are there any questions?
I gather not, Mr. Delia. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. Tim O'Shea for the United States. There are two issues. The first one is whether or not the district court was reasonable in employing a sentence that employed the cocaine-based guidelines. And secondly, whether the defendant has waived his allocution argument by failing to raise it in his initial brief.
Well, we'd also have to look at it under the plain error rule then, though, wouldn't we?
Your Honor, there are two steps to that analysis, or two different ways to look at it, I guess is a better way to put it. The first is this court has held in lots of cases that if a person fails to raise an argument in their initial brief, it's waived, it's gone, goodbye, no argument at all. No,
this is a waiver and not a simple forfeiture.
Well, it's not in the initial brief, so if we take the court's at its word, then it's gone. But if if we deem it forfeiture and we analyze it under plain error, the analysis is a little bit longer, but I think from Mr. Levy's perspective might be we arrive at the same spot. Let's look at it then under plain error.
If we had gone through this record on our own,
sure,
and had noticed that the district court had not granted a right of allocution, we could deal with it, could we not?
Sure. So let's look at it then under plain error. Was there, as you know, there's a four-part test. Was there error? Sure, there was error. Number two, was it plain enough to all of us? Third, the question is if the error affected Mr. Scott's substantial rights. And I think this is where Mr. Levy's argument begins to founder, because Part of that is whether he can show that the error affected the outcome of the proceedings, and it didn't, for three different reasons. And those same three reasons affect the fourth part of the test, and that is whether or not the error affected the fairness, or integrity, or reputation of the judicial proceedings. What are the four reasons? Number one is the court has already observed Mr. Scott already received a sentence at the very bottom of his guideline range. The second thing is, interestingly enough, Mr. Scott actually did directly communicate with the court. He sent a letter to the court that he apparently penned himself, signed it himself. That's in the text of the PSR. Yes, Your Honor.
And when was that letter sent?
That was received by the court on September 7th, 2005, a month before sentencing, and you can find that attached to the PSR, Your Honor.
It was not his reflections on the sentencing procedure.
No, Your Honor.
That is really what part of the right of allocution is about, isn't it? We've been here, you've heard what the government has had to say. What do you have to say for yourself before I lower the boom?
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, it's really not the same to be able to send a letter a month ahead.
Perhaps not. But in any event, under plain error, we're looking, well, there was some direct communication here. The third thing is, it's the defendant's obligation to show that it might have affected the outcome of the proceedings. And clearly here, the defendant hasn't even tried. He hasn't said what he would have said to the court that would have taken him out of the guideline range, below the guideline range. And perhaps Mr. Scott would have been quite eloquent. Maybe he would have had some very interesting, compelling things to say. But in this particular case, given the quantity of the drugs found in Mr. Scott's apartment, the fact that he's got 19 criminal history points, the fact that he's driving around on electronic monitoring selling cocaine base, I respectfully submit that it's improbable he might have had anything to say that would take him below the guideline range. I think he's really kind of a lucky guy to get the bottom of the guideline range at all. In any event, that's just speculation because the defendant has failed to meet his burden at all to tell us, you know, what he would have said. And that's really the question today. I'm going to talk for just a little bit about that first issue, but I wanted to try to answer a question posed to opposing counsel by Judge Coffey, and yes, whether there was a hearing before sentencing where the defendant was told about the penalties. Of course, he would have been observed. I don't have the plea transcript here, but I'm sure at the plea hearing, I'm quite confident that he would have been advised of the penalties he faced. It's in the plea letter. It's something we go over in every plea hearing. You know, the sentence imposed by the district court on Mr. Scott was reasonable for really four different reasons. First of all, it's undisputed that it's in a properly calculated range applying the guidelines. Mr. Scott has not contended, for he alluded perhaps to this morning, but in his briefs he has not suggested that the sentence was unreasonable. As a matter of fact, at page 9 of his reply brief, he says that the court doesn't have to consider whether or not it was reasonable at all. And obviously, post-Booker, that's the big question. And, you know, it's also clear that the district court carefully considered the 3553 factors. I'm not going to explore those this morning. And fourth, the district court correctly chose not to make findings about cocaine-based policy. As this court has held, as the First and Fourth Circuits have held, you know, policy questions are reserved to Congress. That's what the district court said below as well. That's not to say that the district court can't exercise her discretion under 3553A, but those are really individual determinations, not broad policy-based things. For if the 100-to-1 ratio is wrong as to Mr. Scott, then it's wrong as to everybody. And that's really Congress's call. And perhaps Sentencing Commission, I'm sure they are quite qualified and wonderful experts, and they may disagree. I may disagree about the 101 ratio, but it really doesn't matter a lot because that's kind of Congress's call. So that's all for the United States. Any questions from the court? Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Mr. D'Elia has how much time? Sir?
It was not necessary for the court to address the question of whether or not the sentence given was reasonable. In deciding not to give the sentence she would have were she to have properly exercised her discretion, the sentencing judge made a fundamental error that significantly prejudiced the defendant. This actually is Congress's call. Congress is well aware of Booker. Congress is well aware that 3553A is the law. It is this court's responsibility to follow the law, to interpret the law. It's Congress's responsibility to change it if they feel a change needs to be made. It just simply comes down to that. The law is 3553A. The guidelines are not the law. They are a mere tool to be used and considered by judges. When a judge says, I cannot give you a sentence that does not reflect the 100-to-1 that we've come up with in the sentencing guidelines, albeit they've been repudiated and there is no body of experts that would say that it's justified and somehow yet it's reasonable, that's not really the issue that's before this court. The issue is just this simple, 3553A. It is the law. We ask that the sentence be vacated, that Mr. Scott be returned for resentencing, and given the right to allocution at that sentencing. Thank you.
Mr. D'Elia, you also were appointed by this court to represent Mr. Scott, and the court thanks you for your very vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. We very much appreciate your undertaking this case. You've been very helpful to us.
I thank you for the opportunity, Your Honor.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.